From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the British journalist Johann Hari is going to join us to talk about his journey to uncover the real causes of depression and anxiety. Hari has depression himself, and he says this is more than just a chemical imbalance in your brain. It's because we're disconnected from other people and our values and the natural world. His book is called Lost Connections. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Julia Ritchie from KUER's state politics podcast, 45 Days. Every Friday, I get together with my fellow reporter, Nicole Nixon, to break down the latest news and bills from the Utah legislative session. If you live in Utah, this stuff will affect you. So subscribe on your favorite podcast app and sign up for our newsletter at 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Johann Hari was 18 when he swallowed his first antidepressant. In his new book, he describes that moment as feeling like a chemical kiss. And the pill helped, because it was part of a story that came to guide his life for years. The story came from a doctor who told him, this feeling you have of despair, it's not all in your head. You're not being dramatic and weak. You're brain has a glitch in it, and this pill can fix it. Only over time, the pill didn't fix it, not completely, at least not for him. But look, Johann Hari is clear about something. There are people with depression who do have a chemical imbalance in their brains, and that antidepressants can be an important part of their treatment. But he says, we have all been systematically misinformed about what depression and anxiety are. So in the book, he goes on this journey. He traveled thousands of miles, talked to hundreds of people, and he says what he learned forced him to revise that story he'd been told. He learned the primary cause of depression and anxiety is not in our heads. It is, as he puts it in the book, largely in the world. The way we are living in the world. The book is called Lost Connections, and Johann Hari is joining us to talk about it. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Politico. His TED Talk, Everything You Know About Addiction Is Wrong, has been viewed more than 20 million times. He joined us from his home in London. You tell the story in the prologue, barely surviving food poisoning in Vietnam years ago. It was a really bad apple. I wonder, do you mind mentioning this as a way of getting us in here? Because you learned something important about the experience being dreadfully ill, constantly vomiting. But a doctor who was seeing you at the time said something really important. It was a message that maybe we could begin there if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah. All the time I was researching my book about depression and anxiety, Lost Connections, I kept thinking over this thing that happened to me. And I kept wondering, why am I thinking about this, right? Why does this keep coming into my head? And it was only quite late in the 3-year journey of writing the book that I really understood it. So in 2011, I think it was, I'd gone to Vietnam researching a completely different book. And one day by the side of the road, I bought an apple, a really beautiful, big red apple. And I took it back to my hotel room, and like a good person who's read The Lonely Planet Guide, I washed it in bottled water and I ate it. I immediately tasted that it was disgusting, something wrong with it, right? And your listeners can guess what happened next. I got like violently sick the next few days. So got to the fourth day, and I didn't have that much time in Vietnam. I was there to interview survivors of the war for something else. And got to the fourth day, and I just said to the guy who was my like translator and fixer, so lining up my interviews, I just said, you know, let's just go. We'll just do the interviews. It'll be okay. I'll just make myself do this. So we drove really far into the countryside. I think it was 6 hours. And he had lined up for me to speak to a woman in her late 80s who was the only person from her village who survived the war, right? Wow. So I'm sitting there. I'm sitting in her hut. She's telling me this amazing story. And while she's speaking, the room starts to spin around. I've never had a sensation like this before. And just suddenly I just like explode like a bomb all over her like little hut, right? And I say to Huang, my fiction translator, look, just put me in the car, drive me back to Hanoi. I just need a few more days in bed. And the old woman keeps saying something, and he turns to me and he says, she says, you're really ill, you need to go to hospital urgently. So I go to this hospital and they start doing all this emergency stuff. And it turned out what happened is my kidneys had literally stopped working, right? So when I first arrived in the hospital, I was experiencing the worst nausea I had ever experienced. It was horrendous. And they kept asking me these questions about the nausea. And I kept saying, can you get through the translator? Can you give me something to take this nausea away? Mm. And the doctor said to me, no, you need your nausea. It's telling us something. It'll tell us what's wrong with you. And all through the journey of writing this book about depression and anxiety, I kept thinking about what that doctor had told me. You need your nausea. It's telling you something. And it was only much later in the day that I really understood why I kept thinking about that.
We should explain, as you do right at the onset of the book, that that it isn't a book, in fact, about depression. That's been done, and you're glad it's been done, or is being done by others. You're trying to get at something else, the root causes of depression.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, Doug. There were these two mysteries that were really haunting me, if I'm honest, and I was quite frightened to look into them. The first mystery was, I'm 40 years old. I just turned 40 a few days ago. Hmm. And every year that I've been alive, depression and anxiety have increased in the United States and across the Western world. And I was asking, well why? Why are so many of us finding it so hard to get through the day? What's happening to us? Why is this growing more and more with each year that passes? And there was a more personal question. You know, when I was a teenager, I'd gone to my doctor and I'd explained that I had this feeling like pain was leaking out of me. Mm. And I couldn't control it. I couldn't regulate it. I didn't understand why it was happening, and I felt quite ashamed of it. And my doctor told me a story that I now realize has some truth in it, but is way too simplistic. My doctor said, we know why people feel like this. This is just a problem in your brain. Some people naturally have low levels of a chemical called serotonin, which makes people feel good. You're clearly one of them. All we need to do is give you some drugs and you're going to be okay. I remember feeling a tremendous amount of relief. I started taking an antidepressant called Paxil and I felt a really significant boost for a few months. And then this feeling of pain started to come back. So I went back to my doctor. Again, he said, you know, well, we didn't give you a high enough dose, gave me a higher dose. Again, I felt better. Again, this feeling of pain came back a little bit faster this time. And I was really in this cycle of taking higher and higher doses until for 13 years I was taking the maximum dose I could take. And I was still acutely depressed. And I was wondering, well, what's going on here, right? This is the personal mystery for me. I'm doing everything I'm being told by the story that our culture gives us about depression. And yet I still feel awful. What's happening here? So I decided to go on this big journey all over the world. You know, I ended up traveling over 40,000 miles. I really wanted to meet the leading experts in the world about what causes depression and anxiety and what solves them. And just people with very different perspectives, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have very low levels of depression, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that would make people feel better, to a lab in Baltimore where they were giving people psychedelics to see if that would make them feel better. And I learned a huge number of things, but the heart of what I learned is there's scientific evidence for 9 different causes of depression and anxiety. Yeah. 2 of them are, in fact, in our biology. There are real brain changes that happen when you become depressed that make it harder to get out, and your genes can make you more vulnerable to this. But most of the causes are not in our biology. Most of the causes are in our lives, that in the way we're living. That explains, of course, why it's going up so much. And once you understand that, it opens up a very different set of solutions.
You know, it's interesting. A doctor was asking you questions. These are the questions that doctor who gave you that first prescription wasn't actually asking, and it really bothered you. He was like, "Well, look, is there any reason you might feel so distressed? What is it that's happening in your life?" You talk about being resistant to those questions at first because you had that story that guided your life that, no, there's something wrong with your brain. It's simply that. But talk a little bit about how difficult it was to give up that story, because it seems like you struggled with that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, so when people are told this entirely biological story about why they feel this way, initially it feels like a relief, right? Mm. And by the way, there is a lot of truth in it. There are real biological contributions alongside the 7 non-biological factors that cause depression and anxiety that I write about in Lost Connections. But actually, over time, what that says to people is this pain and distress you're feeling doesn't mean anything,
yeah.
Right? It's like a glitch in a computer program. And one of the things that I learned that's so important is that if you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not weak, you're not crazy, your pain actually has meaning. It's a meaningful signal. It's telling us something that's gone wrong in the way we're living. I'll give you something that connects a lot of these causes. Everyone listening to your show knows they have natural physical needs, obviously. Mm. You need food, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. But there's equally strong evidence that all human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. And this culture we've built is really good at many things. I'm glad to be alive today. But we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs. And it's not the only thing that's going on here. But I think it's the key reason why depression and anxiety have been rising year after year after year. So I'll give you an example that can sound a bit fancy and a bit abstract. So I'll give you a very concrete example. In the United States, we are the loneliest society there's ever been. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have who you could turn to in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. And I spent a lot of time interviewing an amazing man called Professor John Cacioppo, who was at the University of Chicago, who was the leading expert in the world on loneliness. And he said to me, why do we exist, you and me and everyone listening to this show, right? One key reason is that our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down. They weren't faster than the animals they took down. But they were much better at banding together into groups and cooperating. Just like bees evolved to live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. Mm. And in the circumstances where we evolved, if you were cut off from the tribe, you were depressed and anxious for really good reasons, right? You were about to die. You were in terrible danger. And those are the instincts we still have. We are the first humans ever to try to disband our tribes. And it's making us feel awful.
One of the questions that comes up in that section of the book with Cacioppo is, what exactly is loneliness? This is something that John was asking about, because it turns out it's not the physical absence of other people. There's more to it than that.
I found this totally fascinating. I'm glad you picked up on this part of the book, Doug. So most people, everyone knows what loneliness feels like, right? Everyone listening to your show knows. If you'd said to me before I started doing the research for Lost Connections, well, what is loneliness? I think I would have said, well, it's isolation, right? It's being cut off from, it's being alone. What Professor Cacioppo found out is that one of the core aspects of loneliness is actually, it's not about how many social connections you have. It's about what he calls reciprocity. Yeah. So you're in a hospital bed, right? You've had an operation. You can push a button and a nurse will be there pretty fast, but you can still feel really lonely because you don't have what's called a reciprocal relationship with that nurse. The nurse will help you, but if you start trying to help the nurse, you're going to be told to stop, right? It turns out the solution to loneliness is having relationships that are two-way relationships, right? They're relationships where you help them and they help you. You watch out for them, they watch out for you. And one of the really interesting and inspiring, because obviously a big part of my book, Lost Connections, is not just about, we don't just want to understand the problem, we want to solve the problem, right? Yeah. We can't carry on every year with depression and anxiety and related problems like addiction going up year after year. So I'm like, I was looking at people who've pioneered solutions based on this all over the world. And one of the heroes of my book is an amazing man called Dr. Sam Everington, who's a general practitioner, kind of family doctor in East London. And Sam was really uncomfortable, because he had loads of patients come into him with just terrible depression and anxiety. And like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. He thinks they have a role to play. Yeah. But he could see two things. Firstly, his patients were depressed and anxious for really understandable reasons, like they were really lonely.
Yeah.
And secondly, he could see that when he gave them antidepressants, it gave them some relief, but most of them did become depressed again. So one day, he decided to pioneer a different approach, which has led to a real breakthrough. One day, a woman came to see him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know quite well later, who'd been shut away in her home with just crippling depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, "Don't worry, I'll carry on giving you these drugs. I'm also going to prescribe something else." There was an area behind the doctor's surgery that was just like scrubland, right behind the suite of doctor's offices, that was just like scrubland. He said to Lisa, "What I'd like you to do is come and turn up a couple of times a week. I'm going to come too. We're going to meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people. I've actually been quite anxious. And together we're going to find something to do." The first time the group met, they were literally, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. But a few things happened. So the group's chatting. They're like, "Well, what could we do?" They decide they're going to turn this scrubland into a garden. These are inner city, East London people. Don't know anything about gardening, right? They start to read books. They start to watch YouTube. As the weeks go by, they start to get their fingers in the soil. They start to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But something even more important happens. They start to form a tribe. They start to form a group. They start to care about each other, right? If one of them doesn't show up, they decide, the rest of them go and look for them. See, are you okay? The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program that found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. And I think for an obvious reason, and this is something I saw all over the world from San Francisco to Sydney to Sao Paulo, the most effective strategies for dealing with depression and anxiety are the ones that deal with the reasons why we're in this pain in the first place. Because this pain makes sense. It's why I kept thinking about that doctor in Vietnam. You need your nausea. Your nausea will lead us to the heart of the problem, right? Once you follow it to the heart of the signal, you can find out what's wrong and then you can find solutions. If I had ignored that signal in Vietnam, I would have died. Right? And these signals are getting louder and louder with each year that passes, right? And not just depression and anxiety, but the subject of my previous book, Chasing the Scream, Addiction. We've been pathologizing that signal. We've been saying it's either a sign of weakness or a sign of craziness. That is not true. It's a sign of something much deeper. There's a Bengali philosopher, Krishnamurti, who said, "It's no sign of good health to be well adjusted to a sick society."
I want to talk to you about another one of the causes you write about, this disconnection from meaningful values. And let's talk about Tim Kasser. He's a psychologist who basically did this, I guess, sort of this scientific investigation to see if overvaluing material things would make you unhappy. And this gets at the things that motivate us. If there's something, are we motivated by the intrinsic things or are we motivated by the material things, by the extrinsic things? Talk about this part, if you would.
There were two of the causes of depression and anxiety that I write about in the book that I found really challenging because I could see how much they played out in my own life, and this is one of them. So everyone knows junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, right? But interestingly, something very similar has happened to our values. A kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. So for thousands of years, philosophers have said, if you think life is about money and status and showing off, you're going to feel awful, right? That's not an exact quote from Confucius, but that is the gist of what he said, right? But weirdly, nobody had actually scientifically investigated this until an incredible man called Professor Tim Kasser, who I interviewed a lot. And Professor Kasser showed a few really, really important things. He showed the more you think life is about money and status and how you look to other people in a kind of superficial way, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious, right? For a simple reason, that way of living does not meet your deeper needs. He also showed, as a society, we have become much more driven by these junk values. We've become much more dominated by them. And in some ways, this is a kind of stupidly obvious insight, right? No one listening to your show is going to lie on their deathbed and think about all the things they bought and all the likes they got on Instagram, right? That's a banal cliche. But as Professor Kasser put it to me, we live in a machine that is designed to get us to neglect what is important about life. From the moment we're born, we are indoctrinated to think the solution to feeling bad is to show off, to buy stuff, to display it on social media, you know. And Professor Kasser did a really interesting experiment to see, well, what can we do about this? Given that we know this causes depression, right? And we know it causes anxiety. And we're living in a hurricane of messages telling you, you don't feel good, buy, buy, spend, spend. What can we do about that? And he did this really fascinating experiment, which people, listeners, can try in their own lives. And there's good evidence this works. So it initially began with a financial advisor, a guy called Nathan Dungan. So he was in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, and his job was to advise people on budgeting, right? And one day he gets a call from a school, and they say, look, we've got a problem here. It was a school in a middle-class area, wasn't rich, wasn't poor. They're like, we've got a problem. The kids at this school are demanding from their parents things like Nike sneakers that the parents can't afford, and if the parents can't afford it, the kids are really losing it, right? They're really getting angry and frustrated. Could you come in and give these kids advice on budgeting? So he goes in and he gives the kind of budgeting advice he'd give to adults. And very quickly he realizes these kids just do not care about budgeting. This is not going to solve the problem, right? There was something deeper going on.
Yeah.
He realized that these kids were valuing the wrong things. They were obsessed with getting these things that actually are pretty meaningless when you think about it. So he's like, why do they want this? So he did this experiment, teaming up with Professor Kasser. So they got teenagers and their parents to come to a meeting. It was just one meeting every couple of weeks for, I think, 4 months. And at first they turned up and they were just, the very first meeting, they just said to both the parents and the kids, I want you to draw up a list of everything you've got to have. They didn't define that, right? Mm. And of course, at first people say, well, you've got to have food and a home and stuff like that. But quite quickly, the kids would say, we need Nike sneakers or whatever it is. And the adults would go, well, I need this fancy car or this fancy handbag or this kind of clothing or whatever it is. And the first few meetings, they'd just say, well, how would you feel if you got those things? And the teenagers would say, well, if I had the Nike sneakers, I would be accepted by my group. I would be envied. Doesn't take long for people to say this out loud before they go, where did you get the idea that being a valuable member of the group just comes from having this like piece of plastic with a particular tick on it? Actually, the parents would often reflect on, why do you think that car is better? Is that actually a better car, or is it just that you think that it's a status thing,
yeah,
how you'd look to other people? So firstly, it was about taking apart the junk values and saying, well, where does that actually come from in your head? Who put that in your head? But the second part to me was more interesting, and this went on for months. It's about saying, well, what actually have been moments of meaning and satisfaction in your life? We don't have these conversations very often in our culture. What have been times when you did feel satisfied? What are things you actually do find meaningful? And different people would name different things. Some people it was playing the guitar. Some people it was taking their kids to the beach. Some people it was riding, whatever it was. But then they started talking about, well, how could you build more of these things, these meaningful values into your life, and less of these junk values? And what was fascinating, this was monitored scientifically, what was fascinating is just having that conversation once every couple of weeks for 4 months led to a really significant shift in people's values, which we know leads to lower depression and anxiety. And this is one of the things that's so important. These insights are just beneath the surface, right? This is not like explaining, you know, quantum physics to someone, right? In our hearts, we know these things. We need two things. We need to be told, actually, this pain you're feeling, we need to connect it to these deeper causes that people intuitively understand. And then we need to give them structured solutions for the way out. Because just saying that, just saying, oh, well, you know, we've been taught to value the wrong things. If you're just left in the middle of this hurricane of messages and this machinery telling you to go the other way, that you know, that's not very helpful. What you then need are structures to find your way out of it.
Yeah. Professor Kasser moved to a farm. And you asked him if he had withdrawal symptoms, and he said he really didn't.
He said, it's, you know, actually, when you get rid of this, he said a word I won't say on the radio, but he said, when you get rid of this useless stuff, you just realize you never needed it all along. But, you know, it's interesting. I remember thinking a lot about Professor Kasser when I went to interview someone else. I went to interview this South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield, who's a wonderful man. And he happened to be in Cambodia in the year 2001, when they first introduced chemical antidepressants in Cambodia. Obviously, it existed in other countries before, but they first arrived there. And the local doctors, the Cambodians, had never heard of these drugs. So they asked him, well, what are antidepressants? And he explained. And they said to him, oh, we don't need them. We've already got antidepressants. And he said, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy, like St. John's wort or something. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer who lived in their community who worked in the rice fields. And one day he stood on a landmine left over from the war with the United States, and he got his leg blown off. So they gave him an artificial leg and he went back to work in the rice fields after a while. But apparently it's super painful to work underwater when your leg's been, you know, when you've got an artificial leg. Mm. I'm guessing it's pretty traumatic because, like, the guy's been blown up in that field. He started to cry all day. After a while, he refused to get out of bed. He developed classic depression. And the Cambodian doctor said to Dr. Somerville, well, that's when we gave him an antidepressant. And he said, what was it? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. Mm. It had causes in his life. They figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was causing him so much distress. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, his depression was gone. They said to Dr. Somerville, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if we've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that sounds like a bad joke, right? Yeah. I went to my doctor for an antidepressant. She gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the leading medical body in the world, the World Health Organization, has been trying to tell us for years. As they put it, we need to talk less about chemical imbalances and more about power imbalances, imbalances in the way we live, right? And we've got to understand its causes. So a big part of what I'm asking in my book, Lost Connections, is, okay, what's the cow for the things that are making us feel this way, right?
Right. I want to ask you about another one of these causes that you write about. I found this really interesting, that another cause is a disconnection from status and respect. And this was really fascinating. This gets us to the insights of this biologist, Robert Sapolsky, who talk a little bit about what he learned from baboon culture that tells us something about status and respect, because this was interesting.
Yeah, I found this totally fascinating. I'm glad you picked up on this. Professor Sapolsky at Stanford is an amazing man. So he went to live in Kenya when he was a young man with a troop of baboons to track them. And he was tracking stress in baboons. When are baboons most stressed out? So basically, baboons live in bands. And the men, interestingly, not the women, the men live in a strict hierarchy. So there's number one at the top, all the way down to number 50 at the bottom. And every single baboon knows where they are in the hierarchy. And where you are in the hierarchy determines what you can take, what you can do. So, and what Professor Sapolsky found was, I mean, discovered loads of fascinating things, but there's two situations in which baboons are most stressed. You measure this by, you take blood samples from them, and there's a stress hormone called cortisol. Yeah. And you, obviously it's highest when they're most stressed. And what he found is there's two circumstances where they're most stressed. One is when their status is insecure. So, for example, the top dog, the top baboon, the king of the swingers, is most stressed when his status is threatened, where people are circling, where someone's coming for him, they're going to try and displace him as number one, right? That's one situation. The other is when you're pushed to the bottom of the pile,
yeah,
when you feel humiliated. And this was one of the fascinating things. So if you are number 50 in a troop of 100, so, and the women are not part of the hierarchy, so you're the bottom of the pile. Very often, in fact, almost always, what baboons at the bottom of the pile will do is they will become very listless. They'll lie very still. They'll cover their heads with their hands. They lose the desire to live, basically. They put their bottoms in the air. This is called a submission gesture. Mm. It's basically saying, okay, you beat me. Please just leave me alone. Don't attack me. Don't hurt me. Because, of course, they can all beat up the one at the bottom of the pile with no cost, right? And what Professor Sapolsky and others have argued is that so this is called a submission response, right? What Professor Sapolsky has argued is part of what's going on in our depression and anxiety crisis, not everything, but part of it, is just a lot of people are being made to feel either like the insecure baboon whose status is threatened, or the baboon at the bottom of the pile who's going, look, I just can't take this anymore, yeah, right? Yeah. Okay, I'm at the bottom of the pile. I've been humiliated. Just leave me alone, right? And I think, you know, there's a lot of evidence that as societies become more unequal, as people are more insecure in their status, and your listeners don't need me to explain that that's happened in the United States to a disastrous degree, that a lot more people just show these responses that come from very deep in our evolution.
Johan Hari. His new book is called Lost Connections, uncovering the real causes of depression and the unexpected solutions. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Johann Hari. We're talking about his new book, Lost Connections. There's a section about disconnecting from the natural world, and I found this interesting. You yourself mentioned that you kept asking yourself this question: why was it that you were so resistant to the natural world all your life? Would you want to say something about that? I guess this gets to ego.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is was a challenging one as well. So animals go crazy in zoos, right? We know this really well. It's called zoocosis is the medical term for it. If you put a horse in a cage, it starts swaying obsessively. Parrots will rip out their own feathers. Elephants will take their tusks, which are like a source of pride in the wild, and they'll grind them down in cages until they're just bloody stumps, right? So animals deprived of their natural habitat lose their minds. And there's a lot of scientists who argue, I spent a lot of time with an amazing Chilean scientist called Isabel Benke, argue that something similar is happening to us. Depression is much higher in places where humans do not have access to the natural world, right? There's a, for example, it's a really fascinating example. The state prison in Michigan wasn't designed this way, but by coincidence, one part of it looks out over beautiful green trees, and another part looks out over just concrete. And it's totally random where you end up in the prison. The people who study this, the people who looked out over the beautiful green trees were 25% less likely to develop mental health problems of all kinds, right? So just like animals need their natural habitat, they need to see it and feel they're in it, we need that as well. And essentially, there's a big debate about why that is. And it's not settled, and there's lots of causes. But one of them, I think, helped me to understand, because like you say, I'm a city boy. I grew up in London. And I actually never liked the natural world, right? And I was trying to think, why is that? And one of the reasons is, I think, so there's a theory that one of the reasons why we feel better when we're in the natural world is that we get released from our sense of ego. Most people confronted with a beautiful natural landscape or waterfall or whatever feel a sense that they are small and the world is big. And one of the things depression is, amongst other things, is a feeling of being trapped in your own ego. Yeah. Your thoughts are rattling around. You can't get out of them. It's a thought of being imprisoned inside your own self. And what the natural world does at its best is give you a sense of relief, a moment of relief. You know, you're part of something much bigger than you, which releases the ego. And I think I found and still find that quite challenging. I had grown up, this is one of the other causes of depression, anxiety, I write about in Lost Connections, but I grew up in an environment where I experienced a lot of some terrible experiences when I was a child, some very extreme acts of violence and some other serious forms of abuse that shouldn't have happened. And I think one of the ways I defended myself from that sense of chaos and fear was through ego, right? It's actually, in that kind of environment, you want to hold on to your ego very tightly. You want to be really vigilant, right? You don't want to let your ego slip for a second because that would endanger you. And so I think I found it quite hard for a long time, and I still do, to be honest, found it quite challenging to have those moments where you surrender control. And this is actually, it's very related to the science about psychedelic drugs, things like LSD and magic mushrooms. And there's been a lot of science emerging around that it can be very effective for depression. And I went and interviewed the scientists who've done that. But again, that's about, very similarly to the natural world, what those things do is, I mean, LSD and magic mushrooms literally switch off the parts of your brain that relate to thinking about yourself and your ego, which can be very freeing, but also very frightening. Everyone knows what a bad trip is as well. It depends on your attitude towards it. And I think for me, I need to feel safer before I can suspend those parts of my ego. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned childhood trauma, and that's actually one of the causes you write about. And you write that for every category of traumatic experience that you go through as a kid, that you're radically more likely to become depressed as an adult. And this fact that you mentioned astounded me. You say emotional abuse is more likely to cause depression than any other kind of trauma, even more than sexual molestation.
There's so many things about the research that you're talking about that I learned about that I found really challenging. If it's okay, I'll tell the story of how this was discovered, because I don't think people can understand it properly if they don't understand this. Yeah. And for a minute, your listeners are going to think, why is he telling us this? This has got nothing to do with depression, but actually it led to this incredible breakthrough. So in the mid-1980s, a doctor who I got to know later, Dr. Vincent Felitti in San Diego, was given a really difficult task. He was approached by Kaiser Permanente, who were the big not-for-profit medical provider there. And they were like, look, we've got a big problem. Every year, obesity is going up and nothing we're doing is working. What can we do? So they gave him quite a big budget and they said, just start working with really obese people and just do blue skies research, figure out what we can do about this. So he starts to work with 250 very obese people, people who weighed more than 400 pounds, who tried all sorts of things. And one day he has an idea that sounds, and in some ways is, quite dumb, but led to a breakthrough. He asked himself, what would happen if really obese people literally just stopped eating? And we gave them, you know, nutritional supplements so that they didn't get, like, you know, like vitamin C so they didn't get scurvy, that kind of thing. Mm. Would they actually burn through the fat stores in their body and get down to a healthy weight? So obviously, with a ton of medical supervision, they started doing this. And incredibly, initially, in one sense, it worked. So there's a patient on the program who I'm going to call Susan to protect her medical confidentiality, who went down from being more than 400 pounds to 138 pounds. It was incredible, right? People are celebrating. Her family are telling Dr. Felitti he saved her life. And then one day, something happened that no one expected. Susan cracked. She went to KFC or whatever it was. She starts obsessively eating. And before long, she's back at this really dangerous weight. And Dr. Felitti calls her in and he says, Susan, what happened? And she looked down and she said, I don't know. I don't know. And he's at a loss. And he said, well, what happened that day, the day you cracked? Did anything happen that day that hadn't happened on any other day? Turns out something happened that day that had never happened to Susan. She'd been in a bar and a man had hit on her, not in a horrible or predatory way, in a quite nice way. But she'd felt really frightened and she went and started obsessively eating. That's when Dr. Felitti asked her a question it never occurred to him to ask her. He said, when did you start to put on your weight? In her case, it was when she was 11. He said, well, did anything happen when you were 11 that didn't happen when you were 9 or 14 or... And she looked down and she said, yeah, that's when my grandfather started to rape me. And he began to interview everyone in the program. He found out 55% of them had put on their extreme weight in the aftermath of being sexually abused or assaulted, which is so much higher than the general population. He's like, what's going on here? How can this be? But Susan explained it to him really well when he asked her. She said, overweight is overlooked. And that's what I need to be. Dr. Felitti realized this thing that seems so irrational, obesity, and of course is really bad for you, right? Was actually performing a function. It was protecting these people from sexual attention, which was something they felt they needed, right? Dr. Felitti said he realized it's like there's a house fire inside these people and we've been focusing on the smoke. But this was a really small study, right? It's like 250 people. You can't draw such big conclusions. So he went to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and he got a big budget to do a much bigger study. Everyone in San Diego who came for healthcare an entire year got given, didn't matter what you came in for, schizophrenia, headaches, broken leg, anything, was given two questionnaires. The first part asked, did any of these 10 bad things happen to you when you were a kid, right?
Yeah.
Things like, you know, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional cruelty, neglect. And then it asked, did you have any of these problems as an adult? And initially it was just obesity. And then at the last minute, they added a load of other stuff like depression, suicide attempts, addiction. When the figures were added up by the CDC, and I spoke to the scientists who did this, they were like, there's been some mistake here. This can't be right. Mm. For every category of childhood trauma that you experienced, you were 2 to 4 times more likely to become depressed or anxious. But when you got into the higher multiple categories, the figures just blew up. If you'd had 6 of those categories of childhood trauma, you were 3,100% more likely to have attempted suicide and 4,600% more likely to have an addiction problem, which is like, you know, I remember when I went to see Dr. Felitti the first time in San Diego. If you met him or any of your listeners met him, you would love him, right? He's a hugely admirable, good, decent man. And I remember shaking with anger when I was talking to him.
Yeah.
I remember finishing the interview early because I was actually worried that I was going to start shouting at him. And I was like, I remember leaving and thinking, why are you so angry with this really lovely man who's done all this amazing work? And it helped me to understand. It comes back to what we were saying right at the start, Doug. It helped me to understand why I had clung to this simplistic biological story that does have some truth in it. There really are things going on in your brain when you become depressed. Yeah. But why I clung to that simplistic story about depression for so long. You know, I didn't want to think about the abuse that I'd experienced as a child. I didn't want to give this individual power over me now. Mm. I just didn't want to go there. But one of the reasons I'm really glad that I stayed with Dr. Felidi's research and I kept talking to him is because of what he discovered next. So if you had indicated on your form to your doctor that you had experienced some form of childhood trauma, your doctor was told, don't call them back in, but next time they come in, say to them something like this. I see that when you were a child, you were sexually abused or whatever the nature of the abuse was. I'm really sorry that happened to you. That should never have happened. Would you like to talk about it? And 40% of people did not want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But 60% of people wanted to talk about it. And they wanted to talk about it on average for 5 minutes. What was incredible was just those 5 minutes of an authority figure saying, I'm really sorry, this should never have happened. That alone led to a really significant fall in people coming back with depression and anxiety. And some of them, it was then random. Some of them were told, well, you can go and discuss it with a therapist. And with them, there was an even bigger fall. And this tells us something really important. And there's lots of growing body of evidence about this. It's not the trauma that destroys you.
Yeah.
It's the shame about the trauma. And giving people places where they can release that shame, safe places, is an antidepressant, right? Anything that reduces depression and anxiety should be regarded as an antidepressant. For some people, that will be drugs. But for many people, it will be a much broader range of options. But the most effective antidepressants are the ones that get down to these deeper causes. Because exactly as we were saying right at the start, and this is why this memory from Vietnam kept haunting me, you need your nausea. It's telling you something, right? It's telling you something about why you feel this way. And by following it back to the source, as painful as that can be, we can begin to find actual solutions rather than just muffling it.
Mm. You know, something that Felidi said in that section of the book to you, I thought was a really important insight. He talked about how medications, yes, they have a role, of course.
Mm.
But we like to think of what is happening to us or other people as mechanistic, not experiential. I thought that was really interesting, that we need to be able to, for some reason, it's comforting to know that there is something mechanical going on. It's harder for us to deal with the experiential stuff.
I think this is such a big mistake that we make, right? We are not machines with broken parts. We are human beings with unmet needs. There's a really dark illustration of this, I think. One of the most amazing people I interviewed for the book is a woman called Dr. Joanne Cassiatore. Mm. Joanne's baby daughter, Cheyenne, died during childbirth. And Joanne became one of the leading experts in the world about traumatic grief. She does amazing work. And she's really exposed something that really goes to the heart of what we're getting wrong. Mm. So in the 1970s, the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, decided for the first time they were going to standardize how they diagnosed depression. So up to then, there was no agreed definition of what depression was. So they drew up a list of 10 symptoms, pretty obvious stuff like crying all the time, you know, feeling life is not worth living. And they send them out to doctors all over the United States, psychiatrists. And they say, if your patients show more than 5 of these symptoms for more than 2 weeks, you should diagnose them as depressed, right? Mm-hmm. Perfectly common sense. But after a few months, psychiatrists start to come back to the APA and they say, look, we've got a bit of a problem here. If we use these guidelines, we're going to have to diagnose every grieving person as having a mental illness because these are the symptoms of grief, right? And of course, that's not what the APA intended. Mm. So they go, right, well, that's not what we meant. There's something wrong here. So they added what they called, what later became called the grief loophole, right? So they said, okay, if someone shows more than 5 of these 10 symptoms for more than 2 weeks, diagnose them as mentally ill, unless someone they love has died in the last, initially it was a year, in which case this is a perfectly normal and sensible reaction. They're not mentally ill. Don't diagnose them, right? And don't give them drugs. But so doctors start using that. But this started to beg a question, right? Dr. Joanne, this wonderful doctor, starts saying, well, hang on a minute. Why is someone you love dying the only reasonable cause of these problems, right? Why not if you've lost your job? Why not if you're stuck in a job you hate for the next 40 years? Why not, you know, all sorts of things, right? Why not if you've been made homeless? But once you acknowledge that there are causes in our lives, the whole system we've built of mental health care just isn't built to deal with that, right? It's not, as Dr. Cacciatore, Joanne puts it, it's not designed to acknowledge context, right? Once you allow context through the door, it's a system based on the model of infectious disease, right? You know, you get a throat infection, you're given an antibiotic, it goes away. That's a great system for throat infections. It's amazing, right? But that's not a good model for mental illness in most cases. In most cases, the causes are much deeper, the pain has meaning, and we have to get to these deeper causes in our lives. And treating mental distress as if it was like an infectious disease just has not worked well for us, right? Yeah. As you can see from the fact that we've been doing that for a long time, and every year, depression and anxiety and addiction and other mental health problems continue to go up and go up and go up. That model has some value. There are some real biological contributions. It's worth dealing with them. But it's not working well for us, right? Yeah. Because it's based on telling us that the pain has no meaning. And actually, this is really disastrous in grief. I mean, Dr. Cacciatore works with people who are grieving, mostly parents, who are grieving in dreadful circumstances. You know, people whose children have been murdered or things like that. What she showed is with parents whose children die while being delivered in childbirth, you know, an extraordinary proportion of them are rapidly diagnosed as mentally ill. In the first 48 hours after the death, 9% of them are immediately drugged, right? Wow. And she argues that really disrupts the grieving process. She argues it's actually an insult to grief, right?
Yeah.
That we grieve because we've loved someone. That's not a pathology. It's not a sickness. That's a necessary part of being human. And I actually think something deeper going on there. I think it tells us something really profound. That depression and grief have the same symptoms, right? Because I think in a way what depression is grief for your own life not turning out the way it should. Mm. Now, with grief for someone who's died, we can love and hold the survivors, but we can't make that right, okay? We can never bring back someone who's died. But with grief for our own lives, there are loads of things we can do to fix that. And the last third of my book, Lost Connections, is all about, well, what can we do for the grief that we feel for ourselves?
Yeah.
And we should listen to that grief and respect it, not pathologize it and say it's a sign of craziness and say it's a sign of brokenness.
Let me ask you this finally. We're talking about such huge social forces that have to be beaten back to be able to find some reconnections. I mean, you're talking about the distractions in the internet and, you know, too much working, all of those kinds of things, these hierarchies that are in place. But you mention in the book that this voice would come to you from time to time that, look, these are such big forces, nothing is going to change, that we're going to be stuck in this place forever. And you say when this voice comes to you, you think of your friend Andrew Sullivan. And I wanted you to say something about that finally, if you would.
Yeah, a lot of your listeners will know Andrew's work, so he's a close friend of mine. He's a journalist. And Andrew was diagnosed as HIV positive at the height of the AIDS crisis in 1993 when there was no treatment in sight. His best friend Patrick had just died. Lots of his friends had died. And Andrew went to a little town in Cape Cod called Provincetown to die. And he decided he was going to do one last thing before he died. He was going to write a book about a crazy utopian idea no one had ever written a book about before. Mm. And he's like, okay, I'll never live to see this idea in practice. No one alive now will live to see this idea in practice. But maybe somewhere down the line, someone's going to pick up this idea. The idea he wrote the first ever book about was gay marriage. And when I get disheartened and I think, we're up against these big forces, I try to imagine going back in time to Provincetown in 1993 and saying to Andrew, okay, you're not going to believe me, but 24 years from now, first thing, you're going to be alive. He wouldn't have believed it. It would have seemed like a miracle, right? Second thing, you'll be married to a man. That'll be legal. Third thing, I will be with you when the Supreme Court of the United States quotes from this book you're writing now, when it makes it mandatory for every state in the United States to introduce gay marriage. And the next day, you'll be invited to a White House that will be lit up in the colors of the rainbow flag. You'll be invited by the president to have dinner with him to celebrate what you and so many other people have achieved. Oh, and by the way, that president who's going to invite you, he's going to be black, right? Every aspect of that would have sounded like ridiculous science fiction. It happened. Andrew's alive.
Yeah.
He saw it all happen. And I've seen everyone listening to this has seen the world transform in extraordinary ways. The women listening to your show don't need me to mansplain this to them. But like my grandmothers, when they got married, weren't allowed to have bank accounts in their own names, right? They had to have a bank account that was a joint account with their husband. There have been extraordinary transformations in our lifetimes. The world can get better when we band together and we fight for it and we don't give up in all sorts of ways. And one of the good things about this crisis is it is telling everyone listening to your program who is depressed and anxious, you are surrounded by people who feel the same way, who have the same hunger for reconnection. And for every person who's being made depressed and anxious by the factors that I write about in my book, Lost Connections, there are loads more people who are being made, whose lives are being diminished by them, right? Whose lives are less happy than they could be. We don't have to live in this way. We don't have to live in ways that make so many of us depressed and anxious and unhappy. We can change the way we live. Human beings before us changed the way they lived many times in ways that made my life better and your life better and the life of every woman listening to this better and the life of so many people listening to this better. But to do that, we have to think about this problem differently. We have to stop insulting depression and seeing it as a sign of weakness or stupidity or just a biological problem. And we have to start respecting it. Because it is telling us something we absolutely need to hear if we're going to survive.
Johann Hari, his new book is called Lost Connections, uncovering the real causes of depression and the unexpected solutions. The book has a website. It's thelostconnections.com. And when you go there, you can actually take a quiz about what you know about depression. Hari joined us from his home in London. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Eva Krisiak in London. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.